Wowza, welcome back to the Conservative Cat Show, and this is a special today. We're happy Independence Day. We are kind of doing something a little bit different today. This is the show where history isn't filtered through political correctness, but through truth. Okay, courage and the grit it took to fight for our freedom. To find the greatest nation on earth, the founding of our country. We're going to be talking about it today. We're not lighting fireworks or talking about hot dogs, although I love fireworks and hot dogs. Today, the memory kind of smells like candle wax and gunpowder. So we're going to be talking about the courage, the blood, and the trembling hands and the heavy hearts. We're going to be talking about the American Revolution, some of the forgotten heroes of the American Revolution. Be sure to subscribe. Hit the subscribe button right now. Like I said, the Conservative Cat Show, we're not going to put history through a political correctness lens. These people, they had true courage, true grit, and they took what it found, they had what it took to find this country. Sorry. I'm a little out of it today. but the Independence Day special is here. I know you've been waiting for it. Men and women who stood up, stood firm, and stood out when nobody was watching, really. So you might know Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, okay, George Washington. I know you know their names, but you might not know the names of the people that we're going to be talking about today. By the end of the show, you are not going to forget these names. So these are the people who gave up everything, and they are worth standing for. Sometimes you've got these people who kneel during the Star Spangled Banner, or when you're supposed to stand up for the national anthem, put your hand over your heart. These people are worth standing for. These people are worth remembering today as you're looking up into the night sky, looking at the fireworks and cooking the hot dogs. Okay, so today we're going to Boston, 1773. So Boston, it kind of smells like fish. There's sweaty men everywhere, and there's fury because the redcoats are in the taverns and soldiers are on every corner. This is Boston, 1773. Parliaments across the sea, they're squeezing the colonies tighter and tighter like a fist around a neck, and they're just wringing this fragile neck that is the colonies. And somewhere down these cobble streets, you have a dingy little shop. Okay, and there's this kid with ink-stained fingers, and he's cursing under his breath, and he's using a typesetter. So look that up, a typesetter. It's where you put the actual letters on, like this typesetter. It's not like your cell phone, okay? And it probably would have me cursing under my breath as well. So imagine this kid. He's cursing under his breath. He's working in this dingy little shop. He's 16 years old. He's skinny, not important, and he's an apprentice at this printing press. Okay, and this is a 18th century version of social media. Okay, he's like a social media influencer, but the 18th century version. And he's just an apprentice at this place. So not a big name, okay? But he's got quite the ear and a memory. Okay, this guy was known for his memory. It was like a lockbox. If he heard a speech, he could repeat it verbatim. He had the memory of a lockbox. So he read everything, by the way, John Locke, and of course, the Bible. He read everything he could get his little hands on, the 16-year-old little boy. His hands were trembling, I'm sure, when he was using this typesetter and when he, you know, the first time he set up his own type. Just watch a video of a typesetter and like how it was. They're not easy to use. Okay. I don't think it was so much that it was hard to use why he was shaking, but he was nervous. Why? Because he knows the truth comes at a cost. Okay. And he writes under a pen name. Everyone did back then because printing was treasonous. If you printed anything truthful, it was treasonous. If it was anti-redcoats, anti-British. So If you printed really anything, treasonous thoughts, then you'd get a visit from the men in the red coats. And he was probably pretty nervous about that. So I'd imagine he's trembling when he's sitting there setting up his type. But he does it anyway. And I think it's because something in him just couldn't stay quiet. You know, journalists of these days, they've got nothing on this kid. 16-year-old kid. I'm telling you, I've worked for several people. They are all weak. They won't print anything that runs, that makes anybody uncomfortable. I've worked for tons of publications. There's very few that are willing to print the truth and do it boldly. And this guy has nothing on the journalist. Like, these journalists have nothing on this guy, the 16-year-old boy that I'm withholding his name on purpose. So I think that there was something in him that just couldn't stay quiet. So it's like Jeremiah 20, verse 9. His word is in my heart like a fire shut up in my bones. I am wary of holding it in. So, yeah, back then, try printing. I mean, people go on Twitter and say outrageous things nowadays, and Facebook and social media, and they just say all kinds of crazy things. Try being a journalist back then. So his pamphlets caught fire, not literally, but King George probably would have wished they had caught fire. Farmers were quoting him from all around, military men. They were citing his stuff from his pamphlets. His essays were showing up in churches. Pastors were using his essays that he was writing, and he did it all under a pen name. And one day he actually, he was called to go meet Sam Adams. The man, not the beer, okay? So Sam Adams tells him, keep writing, the cause needs it. Keep writing. So fast forward to December of 1776, the Continental Army is freezing, okay? Freezing the Northeast, okay? It's pretty cold during the winter months, December 1776. Bleeding, running, you know, morale is really, really low at this point in the war. And there are snowdrifts, right? Tents, and George Washington is getting a little bit desperate, and he needs more troops, and he needs more hope above all. So this boy, now a man at this point, he, you know, 16, 17, 18, he becomes a man, and he writes something called The American Crisis. And you've probably heard this line before. You might not know who I'm talking about yet. Throw it in the comments section. All throughout today, we're going to be talking about these historical figures. If you know who I'm talking about, feel free to throw it in the comments section and spoil it for everybody. But I'm going to withhold their name on purpose until the very end. But this guy, he picks up the pen and he writes The American Crisis. And you've probably heard this line before. These are the times that try men's souls. Those words rung out like a bomb, like a cannon, okay? They hit harder than a cannon. These are the times that try men's souls. These words turned deserters into diehards for this movement, for the cause of freedom, okay? They carried men across the icy Delaware into Trenton and then eventually into history. So who is this man I am talking about today? Who's this 16-year-old, eventually got older, you know, during the course of the war, and wrote The American Crisis? He wasn't a soldier. He wasn't a politician. He was an idea man. He was the brains behind the operation. He was a truth teller. He's somebody we'd call a journalist today. He was a literary blacksmith. His name is Thomas Paine. Thomas Paine. Without him, America might have surrendered in silence. George Washington was getting very desperate there in the winter months of the war, and the Continental Army was freezing. They were bleeding, and they needed more hope above all things. They needed more hope, and this guy's words did it in something called The American Crisis. So you might not know that story or might not have remembered Thomas Paine's name, but he is a guy we're standing for And he's a guy worth remembering when you're looking up into the night sky. Here is his picture. That is Thomas Paine. Totally a guy worth standing for. Now, I want to take you to another story. Another historical figure in the American Revolution that might not get as much as applause as George Washington, Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson. Okay. I want to take you to a night so cold your bones would forget how to warm up and you just can't warm up. This is a night in December of 1776 on the banks of the Delaware River, ice cracking under boots, torches flickering, and the breath of horses. You could see the breath of the horses rising like ghosts into the air. Now imagine you're 25 years old, okay, and you're wearing a tattered coat, not really keeping you that warm, and you're leading a cavalry unit into battle, and you're 25. I'm 26, okay? Not for glory, not for riches, but for an idea, freedom, an idea. He'd been shot not once, but three times. This guy I'm talking about this morning, his home was ravaged by war. His future was uncertain, but he kept showing up through the snow, through the fog, through the screams, through the musket fire. They say ghosts don't bleed. Well, this one did. He didn't write pamphlets like Thomas Paine. He didn't give speeches in Congress. He wasn't signing anything onto parchment, the Declaration of Independence. He had a sword, and he conducted midnight raids, okay? Saber strokes. He signed with, he didn't sign Declaration of Independence. It was a saber stroke, sword stroking through battle. He's one of the most incredible military men of this time period. His name was whispered among the troops. His horse never rested. His sword was never dull. And George Washington trusted him to lead the men and lead his cavalry unit into the belly of British chaos. And I don't know, if that doesn't tell you something about this guy, I don't know what else would. I mean, George Washington trusted this guy. He wasn't just brave. He was something more. He was fast. He was cunning. He was invisible when he wanted to be. Like I said, he was very well known for his midnight raids. The British hated him because they couldn't catch him. He would raid a supply wagon in Jersey one night and then show up in Pennsylvania 2 days later. This guy, I don't think, ever slept. His horse never slept. Maybe he was sleeping on the back of his horse and his horse took him to Pennsylvania just a couple of days after being in Jersey one night and raiding a wagon. He'd wind up in Pennsylvania a couple of days later and capture rations for the starving troops, his men. He didn't leave tracks. He was a legend. This is a quote from this character. And do you guys know who this character is yet? Throw it in the comment section. Like I said, give it away for everybody else. If our nation is to be free, let our enemies fear even our shadows. Whew. The testosterone. Could you imagine the soy boys nowadays? No way. They got nothing on this guy. Okay. Those were his words, and he lived by them, this guy. So, in fact, during the darkest hours of war, December, when George Washington's army, like I said in Thomas Paine's story, this was a point of dwindling, freezing, nearly broken. They were pretty much on the brink of losing this war. This man led a flanking maneuver that turned the tide at Paulus Hook. So Paulus Hook, this is a place, New Jersey. You can visit there today. Just a few dozen cavalrymen, striking fear into hundreds of redcoats. They were very outnumbered, and this was a turning point, really, in the war. Who was this guy? Who was this testosterone-laden guy? I'm just going to say he's got high T. That's Henry Lee III. History remembers him as Light Horse Harry Lee. His father... yes, Robert E. Lee. But long before that name meant anything, he was the one who the British feared the most, Henry Lee III, the British, they couldn't keep up with this guy. This guy stood for agility, duty, liberty, not in theory, but in practice. His hooves pounding in steel, flashing. He carved out a kind of courage we don't really teach anymore in school, or we demonize this sort of masculinity, and we don't teach this kind of courage anymore. So Light Horse Harry Lee rode for something bigger than himself. He rode into smoke and came out on the other side with victory clenched in his teeth. Okay, between his teeth. He was a victorious guy. And he knew it wasn't easy, but he knew it was the right thing to do. And he really didn't ask for fame. A lot of people don't know this name, Henry Lee III. A lot of people don't know him. He wasn't a guy who wanted fame, but he earned it. He got a nickname, Light Horse Henry Lee. I think it's because, like, his horse was very light on his feet. Like I said, he could go from New Jersey one day and in a couple days get up to, on horse, get his cavalrymen up there to Pennsylvania in just a couple of days. So he earned it. He earned the fame. He didn't demand liberty. He didn't, you know, write it in a pamphlet, which, not to disparage anything that Thomas Paine was doing, but he wasn't like behind a, you know, pen and paper demanding liberty. He actually delivered liberty through blood, through sweat, through tears. And his name was Light Horse Harry Lee. That is a name worth standing for, folks. So all those people in your sports arenas who bend the knee and kneel before the flag and won't stand for the national anthem, shame on them, because there were people like Thomas Paine and Henry Lee, the third. So his name is worth standing for. I do want to get to another patriot here. You're watching the Conservative Cat Show. This is a special Independence Day show where we are going through the forgotten heroes of the American Revolution. This guy is a Black patriot, a Black man. He was born into a world that told him he was property. Okay, a world where liberty was ink on paper. Okay, where it was just an idea, but not for him. His name didn't appear on any kind of declaration. He was a Black man. Okay, his fingerprints, though, are all over freedom and the American Revolution. So imagine, put yourself in this guy's shoes. It's a Black man standing on Lexington Green in 1775, British soldiers loading muskets, smoke, chaos. And at the center of it all, there's this Black man, musket in hand, facing death without blinking. Okay, he wasn't supposed to be there, not according to the rules of the time, but God doesn't care about man's rules when he calls you to be a warrior. Okay, so this guy was obviously called to be a warrior. He's a Black man. He fought at Bunker Hill in the thick of it, in the thick of war. He fought at Bunker Hill, and the story goes that he's the guy who actually shot this British major, and this was another big turning point in the war. This was a big major, British Major Pitcairn, a man who just days before getting shot shouted out at the rebels, "Lay your arms, ye villains." Okay, so he called the Americans, or what would be the Americans, the colonists, he called them villains. He said, "Lay down your arms, lay down your weapons, ye villains." Well, somebody laid him down instead, and it was this Black man. It's said, the story, you know, this is debated, I guess, that he was the guy who shot and killed this major, this British major guy in the army. So it didn't stop there, though. He served in multiple battles. This Black man fought alongside white soldiers, earned their respect. And when the war ended, the government gave him something that Black men really rarely got in that time, during that time period, land. Those days, Black men having land, not a thing ever before heard of. He was one of the only ones. And why? Because the politicians knew that this guy was owed more than just a thank you or a verbal thank you. He was owed soil. He was owed roots in a future in America. So he stood in the face of tyranny abroad, and he stood despite the hypocrisy at home. It takes a lot of cojones, okay, to fight for freedom when you know that you're enslaved to these people who are signing the Declaration of Independence. He fought for this idea because he liked what the Declaration of Independence said in it. All men are created under God, equal under God. And he believed in this, and he believed in those words, and he believed in the hope that he too would be one day free. And he was fighting for freedom that wasn't going to be perfect. And he knew that. He knew that freedom wasn't perfect. But he believed in a dream enough to fight for it anyway. He didn't bow, but he stood. So I think he was eventually released and given his freedom. In those days, he was actually given land, which is a big deal for a black man. But he didn't fight for himself. He fought for an idea, and he fought for a country he didn't even get to really see in full form, at its full, like today, where black men, white men, white women, everybody's free. And everybody can be whatever they want to be. He didn't even get to see this country in its full form yet, but he fought anyway. Who's this guy? His name is Peter Salem. Peter Salem. He was a man of really silent courage. He was a patriot before the Constitution even counted him. So he was a patriot, and he wasn't even really supposed to be a patriot, but he was. Because he believed in this idea, and he is definitely somebody worth standing for. He's definitely somebody worth remembering as you're looking up at the night sky and the fireworks. Now, I want to get to a few others. I'm going to take a quick break. Smash that like button, share this out with your friends, and I'll be right back.
Check your blind spots. Men love to call things out. Weakness, hypocrisy, failure. We're wired to spot threats and take action. But Jesus didn't say, never judge. He said, judge not that you be not judged. Why? Because judgment without humility is a trap. It turns you into a sniper with a log jammed in your eye. Matthew 7 hits hard. Jesus calls out a man who sees a speck in his brother's eye, but ignores the plank in his own. He's not saying don't correct. He's saying clean your lens first. Self-examination before confrontation. It takes guts to get real with your own sin. To admit you've gone soft. To face your pride, lust, laziness, or bitterness head on. But that's what real men do. They sharpen themselves before they sharpen others. Jesus didn't just want behavior police. He wanted heart warriors. Men who get the plank out, then humbly help a brother see clearly. Men who don't just flex spiritual authority, but walk with spiritual maturity. In verse 6, it's about discernment. Don't toss holy things to pigs. Don't waste truth on ears that mock it. Know when to speak. Know when to walk away. Before you blast through your next workout, check your form. Same with life. Patriot Pump fuels clean, focused energy, but you've still got to show up. Power with purpose. Clarity with strength. That's how you train. That's how you lead.
Hey, good morning. You're listening to Conservative Cat. I appreciate you being here. Go ahead and subscribe. I'll take some of your chats. Great history lessons. Love your show. Better than coffee in the morning. There's very few things better than coffee in the morning. I appreciate you being here this morning. Happy Independence Day. We are doing an Independence Day special. I don't know if I showed you guys Henry Lee. Henry Lee, here's a picture of him. I talked about him a little bit earlier. This is the guy who I'm just going to peak masculinity. Okay. He wasn't like Thomas Paine, who I talked about a little bit earlier. Thomas Paine was the guy who had great penmanship, wrote The American Crisis, really provided hope. Words do have power, provided hope to George Washington's army when they were dying in the dead of winter. And they were on the brink of losing this war. And Thomas Paine's words stuck with them and turned deserters, because people were leaving the war. People were deserting the war and deserting the cause. His words turned deserters into diehards. Now, we talked about Henry Lee the Third, his father, Robert E. Lee. He is the father of Robert E. Lee. But he was called Light Horse Henry Lee. Light Horse Henry Lee. So Henry Lee had this incredible way of being everywhere all the time in battle. So he was in New Jersey one day, would ride his horse in 2 days to Pennsylvania. He was an incredible military man, and George Washington entrusted him to lead the cavalrymen into battle, multiple battles. Peak testosterone, peak masculinity. Before we took the break, I was telling you a little bit about this guy. His name is Peter Salem. Peter Salem, a black man. A black man who really wasn't supposed to be there. He was a patriot before the Constitution even really counted him. But he believed in this idea, and he didn't even really get to see the country that would see his full worth as a person. But yet he faced tyranny abroad. He fought. He held a musket. And in fact, he killed, it's debated, but it's said that he shot British Major Pitcairn. This was a guy who shouted things like, "Lay down your arms, ye villains." He was a huge British military man. And he fought at Bunker Hill. And in the thick of that battle is when he shot, killed this Major Pitcairn, I believe. So, good stuff. These are people worth standing for. I do want to get to a woman this time. So, not every soldier, I want to be clear, wore a uniform. Not every warrior carried a gun. There were women during this time period, and some women fought, like this woman, with laundry lines and codes, coded prayers. Okay, she fought with hymnals. She carried around the Book of Psalms with her, hymnal book with her. And she did this all while the British were drinking tea in her living room, and they did not suspect her as a rebel. So she was a loyalist wife. So they thought, they thought that she was not a part of the American Revolution, but she was a mother, she was a Quaker, and she was a very humble woman from Long Island. She cooked, she cleaned, she listened, and in her hand was a psalm book, a book of songs, a hymnal. And inside it, she had intelligence reports, coded messages, all of this, okay? And she would have the British people over to her parlor, and they'd be drinking tea, like practically in her living room, okay? And they had no idea her name. I'm not going to give you her name just yet. Do you know who this woman is? Throw it in the comment section if you have any idea. So she, like I said, mother, Quaker, nobody would have suspected her as being a rebel, okay? So she used black petticoats and handkerchiefs on a clothesline. This is a really incredible story to signal passing troops or passing ships. One cloth meant danger, another meant cargo secured, and if you didn't know the code, it just looked like laundry, obviously, on this clothesline. But if you did, it meant life or death. So she kind of served as like a, this clothesline that she had served as like a warning, and she would gather intel. She was actually part of the Culper spy ring. This is a big way, and actually called by George Washington, one of the most vital intelligence networks in the Revolutionary War. Okay, so she was part of this Culper spy ring, and she'd spy on the British. She'd get their intelligence and, you know, their intelligence reports, stick them in this hymnal, and then she would use this clothesline, and she would hang black petticoats and handkerchiefs to kind of alert the American, the soon-to-be Americans, the colonists, of what was coming, these passing ships. So George Washington called this work within the Culper spy ring crucial. So her work was crucial. She was never caught. She was never exposed. The British never suspected that a woman baking biscuits in her kitchen was feeding troop locations to Washington's men. Like, this is absolutely incredible. And nobody really knows her name. Maybe you do. Throw it in the comment section. Share this out with your friends. Subscribe to the channel. But why did she do it? I mean, this was very risky. If she had been caught or exposed, she'd be dead. Why'd she do it? It's because tyranny knocked on her door and she opened it with a smile and she burned it down with the truth. She burned it all down with the truth. And this wasn't about really espionage. It was about faith, courage, and motherhood. This woman risked everything for her family, her home, her soul, to tip the balance of the war. So that's really what she did. She tipped the scales of war in the favor of the Americans, or the soon-to-be Americans. Her name, she didn't get a lot of credit for this. She didn't ask for credit. She was a very humble woman. Her name was Anna Smith Strong. Anna Smith Strong. Let's pull up her photo. Anna Smith Strong. She's not in most textbooks because... God forbid we teach women that, hey, there's power in being quiet and being humble and not asking for credit. And there's power in that. And she used this front, essentially, of her baking cookies or biscuits in the kitchen. And really, she was like a spy, a crucial spy, as George Washington put it. So... she's not really in textbooks, but she lived in Setauket, Long Island, during the British occupation. Her family was very wealthy, influential, and outwardly she played like this well-mannered loyalist wife. Her husband, Selah Strong, was arrested in prison for Patriot sympathies. So the Patriots versus Redcoats, right? He had Patriot sympathies and he was arrested. So she was always under suspicion. And yet, despite her, you know, being under the suspicion because her husband had actually, you know, expressed these and was in prison for Patriot sympathies, the British soldiers and these officers, they sat in her living room sipping tea and, you know, talked all this information with her. And she was secretly a spy for the Continental Army. I mean, she was running signals for the Culper spy ring, passing intelligence from Abraham Woodhull, Culper Sr., to Caleb Brewster. So these are some other names who ferried it across Long Island Sound to General Washington. So, I mean, she was passing intelligence to these big names in the Revolutionary War, and she did this all mainly quietly through this laundry line where she would make intelligence drops, and she kind of hid it on this laundry line, which, I mean, she was a spy hiding in plain sight. I mean, absolutely incredible. She hosted the enemy in her home while orchestrating their downfall from her backyard. From her backyard on this laundry line, she orchestrated their downfall, and then she had them in her house sipping tea. I mean, this was the ultimate act of patriotic defense, defiance. And this was cloaked. It was patriotic defiance cloaked in politeness. And a lot of women today, like Yuri AOC's or people in Congress, these women, Jasmine Crockett, I don't know if polite would be a word that I would use to describe these types of women. So this was patriotic defiance done with politeness. And that is somebody we're standing for. I don't know about you, but Anna Smith Strong, she was definitely a woman worth, or she's definitely a woman worth standing for and thinking about as you're looking at the night sky and the fireworks. I've got a few more today. We're going to go until I pretty much run out of these. Smash that like button, share this out with your friends. This is something that you definitely want your kids to hear. So save this, find me on Spotify. It's also available on Apple Podcasts. Save this and share this out with your kids. Share it with your kids because these are history lessons. And a lot of these people are not in textbooks, your history textbooks. They are long, long forgotten, and they are the forgotten heroes of the American Revolution, of the Revolutionary War. So let's get to another guy. This is one of my favorites. You guys are really going to like this one. The pulpit is supposed to be a place of peace, okay, especially back then. Definitely a place of peace, a sanctuary, okay? The pulpit is meant to comfort the weary, guide the lost, lift the eyes of men toward heaven. But what did this guy do? Well, he realized that the wolves were at the gate. They were already inside the gate, okay, the wolves. And this is a preacher, and he was a preacher in the bitter winter of 1775. So the snow clung to his boots. I think I was saying winter of 1776. December of 1775 was brutal, okay? This was the point in the war where people didn't think that there was any hope, okay? So the question facing this one preacher is, what do you do when the wolves are inside the gates? Okay, so the snow clung to his boots during the winter of 1775 as he entered the church that morning and he looked out over his congregation. There's farmers, there's fathers, there's tradesmen, there's sons, and they're all sitting in the pews pretty quietly. And he looks out over his congregation one morning. It's the cold, bitter winter, and some of them had walked miles just to hear a little bit of scripture. These people were really looking for hope at this time because this was the perceived end of the war. This was, okay, we're on the brink of losing this thing. And they just needed a word of peace. So they went to this preacher's church and they got one. He opened up Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Whew. I mean, I am getting chills. This is exciting. So this preacher, he opens up the word of God and he says, Ecclesiastes chapter 3, to everything there is a season, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck what's been planted, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time for war, and a time for peace. He paused. He let the weight of that silence in his sermon just hang there. You know, the weight just was on all of these people in those pews, the tradesmen, the farmers, the fathers, the sons, the people who had walked miles just to hear this scripture. He let it just sit there and marinate that scripture, that word. And he closed the Bible. And with a steady hand, he untied. So back then they had like almost like a black clerical type robe. And he untied the robe and the robe fell. And the congregation stirred. They were like, and the women gasped. They were like, what? And slowly, methodically, as if the sermon wasn't over, just the beginning, he pulled off the robe. The robe fell from his shoulders, fell onto the floor, and underneath, a continental officer's uniform. Okay, complete with a sword, a belt, a powder horn, and the silence broke. Gasps, murmurs, chairs were scraping. A man stood up, and people left, I'd imagine. People left the pews. I mean, think about this, a pastor. So think about it in our time. Say a pastor were to, you know, call for you to take to the streets and start protesting, or say, okay, so during the BLM riots, okay, the 2020 BLM riots, a lot of preachers were silent about that. Say you had a preacher back then who said, okay, we are going to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. There was at the height of the BLM riots. That was a pretty rough place. We're going to Milwaukee. We're going to get into a bus and we're going to show up and we're going to make our voices heard in Milwaukee, and we're going to make sure that we're armed so that way we, you know, like this is huge. Where a preacher reveals a gun or like a sword at that time, but say a preacher were to reveal a gun at his hip, okay. Now we're led to believe that, you know, the pulpit is a place of peace. The church is a place of peace. But underneath, you had this Continental Army's officer uniform and a sword, okay, a sword belt. And the silence just completely broke, and people were whispering and murmuring, and they were gasping. And finally, the preacher spoke, and he broke his silence, and he says, "There is a time to preach, and there is a time to fight. And now is the time to fight." Okay, I don't think that we were at this level, obviously, during the BLM riots. But I'm trying to give you an idea of it. Had the war, had there been a straight up civil war that had broken out over the BLM riots, or it had gotten really, really bad, okay, a preacher would reveal a gun strapped to his hip, you know, at the pulpit and tell you to fight. I mean, this is an intense moment. Okay. So the pastor became a patriot. He said, "There's a time to preach, but there's a time to fight. And now is the time to fight." That's what he says. So the preacher's name, don't worry, we'll get to that. Maybe you know the preacher's name. Go ahead, throw it in the comments section. Smash that like button if you're here. So he stepped down from the pulpit, and he stepped down, and he really called people to go fight. He called people to bear arms, and he didn't preach resistance, okay, from behind the pulpit, because there is a big difference between a preacher who says, okay, go out there and fight, and he doesn't go do it himself, I think. He led it, okay? So he was in the Continental Army officer uniform that very afternoon, right behind the church, 300 men enlisted, enlisted in the local militia there under his command. So there, he made a militia. And at this time, like I said, in the winter of 1775, this was when the war had gotten to a point where they thought that they were going to lose. So he didn't shake hands and wish them well on their journey to go fight. He trained them. He was their commander. He was under their command, and 300 men enlisted that afternoon after the sermon, and they marched with him and they bled with him. So he was no career soldier. He wasn't a professional fighter. He was a guy, a Lutheran minister, and he saw this rising tide of tyranny. He knew that the hour demanded fighting, not more words. Okay, so it took a lot of courage. So while other ministers debated whether Christians should take arms, a lot of people would say, like, hey, if you're a Christian, you shouldn't enter the war because you're a Christian. You should be anti-war, right? I mean, even back then, they were talking and debating about whether Christians should enter the war. History kind of repeats itself. Here we are, we're talking about, there's Candace Owens, Tucker Carlson, they're saying, hey, Christians shouldn't be involved in the Israel versus Hamas or Israel versus Iran conflict. We shouldn't get involved. There is a time for war. There is a time for peace. And Christians were debating whether they should take up arms at this time. And wars, they kind of have a way of turning ideals into scars. This war particularly had a way of turning these Christian ideals or these ideas of just peace. And I really like how the pastor or the preacher here, he used Ecclesiastes. So the Bible commands us, hey, there is a season for everything. And sometimes the season is war. So the preacher, he fought in Brandywine. He fought in major wars, stood firm at Mammoth, where men dropped from heat stroke, by the way, and smoke. Yorktown. This was a final blow that toppled the British crown in the colonies. So, I mean, he fought in major wars. This was raw American courage, where British bayonets clashed with raw American courage on the battlefield. Brandywine, this was a infamous battle. Yorktown, that was the final really blow that toppled the British crown, and he was a part of it, this preacher. So he didn't just fight, he led. He gathered 300 men. He prayed over men as cannonballs, of course, thundered. And I think that he was called for such a time as this because he had he was a Lutheran minister, and there was hope that was needed, especially during that time in the winter. So he preached before sunrise sometimes, and he would actually baptize these soldiers in the rivers before they marched really into hell on earth. He would baptize them. He would preach for them. And he was preaching on the battlefield and like alongside them in this continental uniform, army uniform. And his sermons changed. It was less about, you know, daily bread and more about heavenly liberty. He spoke of God who made men free and of a king who tried to undo it. And that's how his sermons really changed. How God creates us all equally and free, and he makes us free. And this king wants to do away with what God intended for this for us. So the British had a name for him, actually, which, I mean, this is kind of interesting. And I'm going to get to his name here in just a second. Black Robe Regiment. Okay, so they gave him a name, and it was meant to be an insult, but he wore it like a badge of honor. Okay, he wore it like armor. He was the Black Robe Regiment. So because of tyranny, he said, hey, this isn't just a political problem. This is a spiritual problem. You know, Jesus Christ died for our spiritual freedom. And these men and women died. And there are women. I'll get to Deborah Sampson here in just a second. Oh, I released her name. See, I said I wasn't going to do that. I'm going to get to a woman here in just a second. But there were men, women who died for our nation's freedom. And it was all done in the American Revolutionary War. So his nickname was Black Robe Regiment, which I found absolutely hilarious. I mean, they thought he wore it like armor. He was like, yeah, I'm the Black Robe Regiment. So in his mind, the revolution wasn't really about taxes or the red coats or anything like that. It was really a political one. This was about truth versus lies. This was about light versus darkness. And this was about our spiritual freedom. And hey, Jesus Christ died for our spiritual freedom. God intends for us to be not only free from our sins, but free from oligarchs and kings who try to undo our earthly freedom here. And the Bible told him what side to be on. His Bible told him, hey, Ecclesiastes chapter 3, there is a time for war. And he said, there's a time to preach, but there's also a time to fight. So he didn't seek a statue, nothing like that after the war, when the fighting was over. And freedom was no longer just ink on a piece of paper, on parchment. He laid down his sword. So he was done. He wasn't like a general. He didn't stay in the army or nothing. He didn't seek a statue or a title afterwards. And this is where the same church that began it all, where the robe had hit the floor and liberty had really taken its first breath, he went back to that church. He returned home to that pulpit, to the place where it all began. And he kind of said, there's a time for peace. And he went back to the pulpit to preach. There's a time to preach and there's a time to fight. So he went back, and his words were different, obviously. When he preached sermons, they were heavier, they were tested, they were true. He had watched friends die. Okay, I mean, that has got to be a totally different type of sermon. He had seen the cost of freedom in real time, up close, not in speeches, right? Not like a lot of us, we hear about the cost of freedom in speeches or on podcasts like this one. Very rarely do you encounter someone who sees the cost of freedom up close. Okay, so he saw shattered bones, blood, And he didn't just hear about it in speeches. So that really changed his sermons. But he never regretted it for a single moment, because he knew that the price of peace is not, being silent is not going to bring about peace. Okay. And he knew that. He believed that the church must always be conscious of a nation. And hey, this whole separation of church and state thing, he did not believe that at all. He said, hey, and really the separation of church and state, that it's not intended. What it really was intended for was that, hey, the government can't come into the church. It's not that the church can't go into government. So he stepped out from behind his pulpit when the wolves were inside the gates. And in closing, I do want to say this guy's name. I think I've withheld it this whole time. John Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg. Okay, so he was actually the son of German immigrants, became a disciple of Christ. And he didn't stumble into faith on the battlefield. Okay, a lot of these men, they came to faith on the battlefield because they were looking for hope. He brought his faith to the battlefield, rather, and he was baptizing these people in rivers and preaching during the sunrise before they went into war. And he didn't just ask God to bless the nation. He fought to give that nation a chance to be blessed. Okay, so that, my friends, he is definitely a man worth remembering. Let me pull up. Here he is. Wow. Absolutely incredible. That is the Black Road Robe Regiment. That's him. That is a name worth standing for, friends. Smash that like button. Share this out with your friends. Subscribe to the channel if you're just tuning in. Today, we're doing a very different type of show. I'm walking you through the forgotten heroes of the American Revolution. And so far, I mean, we've talked about Peter Salem. This was a black guy who killed a major in the British Army. And he was fighting for something that he didn't even really get to see as a black man. He did get land, which was very rare for black men back in that time, but he fought for an idea, and he fought for an idea when he knew that he wasn't even going to get to see it in its full fruition, come to full fruition. Thomas Paine, he was what I'll call a journalist. Had these pamphlets, and he was a young kid, very skinny, very sickly, 16 years old. He was a nobody. And then eventually he wrote The American Crisis. And he was told that by many founding fathers, he was told that, hey, your works actually led to us winning the war. The American Crisis led to us winning the war because it turned deserters into diehards for the movement. And his words were very, very powerful. And like I said, this guy, Henry Lee III, he was the father of Robert E. Lee. He actually was probably one of the greatest military men of all time. I have to say, I mean, it's kind of incredible. Like they said that they called him Light Horse Henry Lee because he was able to go to New Jersey to Pennsylvania in just a couple of days. And he was very light on his feet. And people said, oh, this guy never sleeps. And the British hated him. Because they couldn't keep up with him. He just is the epitome of agility. We also talked about Anna Smith. Anna Smith was a spy, and she used her clothesline to provide intelligence, British intelligence. She would have the British people come to her living room. Her husband was a loyalist, but he had patriot sympathies. He was a British loyalist. He had patriot sympathies for the Americans, or would-be Americans, patriots. And he was imprisoned for that, but they believed that she was still a loyalist wife, that she was, you know, just this woman who was in the kitchen baking biscuits, and she was not sympathetic to the patriots. So they would come have tea there at her house, and she would gather intelligence, and she would stick that intelligence in a hymnal, and she'd carry this hymnal with her, and she would use the clotheslines to warn the patriots of battleships coming in. And of, you know, troop locations, she used like a code, like with handkerchiefs, and one handkerchief meant dangerous, another one meant, you know, something else. So this was kind of incredible. And she did it all with politeness and with humility, and nobody even suspected her as a spy. So I do have a couple of others, I think. I am going to get to this one. She was the soldier who was never supposed to be there. She was raised in silence, not the peaceful kind. Okay. She was raised in a silence that surrounds an abandoned child. Okay. So she grew up in Massachusetts. Her father had disappeared. Her mother was crushed by poverty, and she couldn't feed any of her children. So eventually she was sent away, this woman. I'll get to her name here in just a second. She was sent away, not to a family, but to indentured servitude as a 10-year-old. Okay, so this is a big deal. She scrubbed floors, milked cows, hauled firewood through snow, okay? And she was just a little girl. And the world didn't have time for a little girl, so she lived in silence, and it was not a peaceful kind of silence. She was abandoned as a child. And not in 1760s, okay? 1760s, colonial America, little girls, the abandoned little girls, there was no time for the abandoned little girls. So she taught herself how to read by candlelight. She tore pages from her Bible, from her school books, and would take them. You know, she didn't have money, right? She'd take these torn pages from a Bible or from her school books, and she would read them by candlelight at this woman. So the Bible especially stayed with her. She clung to it. She underlined it. She memorized it. And it gave her two things she'd never had, okay, before. This is an abandoned child. Truth and identity. She knew who she was because she was a daughter of Christ. And in her 20s, the colonies, okay, had erupted. The war started happening, okay, the Patriots versus the British. And the British crown had gone from being a distant ruler to a very present tyrant in the colonies. Taxes, obviously, taxation without a voice, soldiers in homes. The British would bring their soldiers and put them in homes. Churches were under scrutiny, and 1775 at Lexington and Concord, blood had finally spilled. So people were turning into soldiers. The Patriots started to rise when she was in her 20s, this woman. Farmers became rebels, and women, they were told to wait. They were told to support, to pray, and to sow. And there were women, I'm not disparaging those women who supported, who prayed, and who sowed. And, I mean, that was all very important. But this woman, and like I said, she had her identity. She clung to her Bible. She memorized it. She had her identity because she had her Bible, and she wasn't interested in waiting, and God had a calling on her life. So she had had enough of the world, and she knew freedom wasn't going to be given, that freedom had to be taken away from the British army, okay, and from the British. So she made a choice. She bound her chest up, so like flattened her chest and bound it up. She cut her hair very short and stitched together a Continental Army uniform from scraps. Okay, so she took the name of a man, Robert Shurtleff, okay, and walked into an establishment camp in Massachusetts. And just like that, she vanished, not into hiding, but into history. Okay, she didn't hide. She went right into the belly of history. She drilled, she marched, she slept out the dirt like the rest of the soldiers. She joined the 4th Massachusetts Regiment and marched over 500 miles and fought in multiple engagements, including a vicious skirmish near Tarrytown, New York, where she was shot in the leg. Okay, so she fought in multiple engagements. She was joined this 4th Massachusetts Regiment. And right here is where she gets shot in the leg, this woman. Okay, so she shot in the leg, Tarrytown, New York. Now, most soldiers who took a musket ball, okay, a musket ball to the thigh, they went to the field surgeon. This woman obviously she couldn't go do that. If she did, they'd discover her secret. She didn't do that. So instead, under the cover of night, she slipped away from Kent and removed the musket ball herself with a knife and a sewing needle. Alone? No anesthesia. Okay, no help. And she couldn't cry, right? Because it was the dead of night. She couldn't give herself up. That's grit. And it's not just grit. It's God. This is just raw courage. And that doesn't happen unless God bestows it to you. I mean, this was clearly the Holy Spirit working in her. So she had gotten up and she had went back to her unit. No parade, no promotion, just duty. Okay. And eventually she fell ill with a fever, the kind that leaves a man, or in this case, a disguised woman, unconscious. So she fell ill with fever, went unconscious, and she was taken to a hospital in Philadelphia. And this is where her secret was finally revealed, unraveled. Okay. The doctor in charge, Dr. Barnabas Binney, discovered the truth and said nothing, not a word to anybody that this was a woman. He saw in her not scandal, but valor. He informed George Washington himself, the doctor, informed George Washington, General George Washington. Now think about that. The father of our nation, a founding father, a man of order, discipline, dignity. He should have and could have condemned her. But guess what he did? He could have had her dishonorably discharged. He didn't even do that. He could have punished her. He didn't do that. He called her into the headquarters. Come here. Come here. Come here, girl. Then Washington handed her honorable discharge and enough money and a note of deep respect. He saw the truth, that she had courage, and that courage was not bound by gender or the limits of society. She had courage bestowed to her by God. And he saw that. He saw the truth. And he honorably discharged her from service. And after she left the war, she returned home back to her real name and her quiet life as a farmer's wife. She went and she became a wife and lived out a quiet life. But her fight wasn't over. You see, she really had served her country, risked everything, and yet she didn't receive a pension. So she wanted a pension. She didn't get recognition. She didn't really want the reward. She did fight. So she petitioned later the Massachusetts legislature, writing friends of the revolution, including Paul Revere, to advocate on her behalf. And eventually she became the first woman in American history to be granted a full military pension for combat service. So she didn't just break the mold here. She shattered it. Okay. So she got her pension. So she is a name worth standing for. Do you guys know her name? Throw it in the comment section if you do. Her name, Deborah Sampson. She was a farmer's daughter. Her father did abandon or disappeared. That's what we know from history. And her mother was crushed by poverty and she was sold into indentured servitude. She was a reader of the Bible, taught herself how to read by candlelight, tore things out of the Bible, read it and memorized it. And she was a volunteer in a war that really had no room for her. But that kind of courage, I mean, I don't think that the war could have been won without her. Everybody was important during this time. And she's not a woman who found God in war. And like I said, a lot of men found God in war. She was a woman of God that went to war. And the only way that she was able to carve the musket ball out of her leg in the dead of night and sew herself back up without any anesthesia, I'm telling you, that is an act of God. And Deborah Sampson, she was willing to bleed for freedom. This Independence Day, we should remember Deborah Sampson. Deborah Sampson. All right, I'm going to take a quick break. I've got a couple of more I want to get through. And I'm going to take a quick break, but smash that like button, share this out with your friends. I'll be right back. Hey, good morning. You are listening to Conservative Cat. I appreciate you being here. I've got a couple of more that I want to get to here, but I do want to show you this one's picture. This was Deborah Sampson. Deborah Sampson had cut her hair short, bound up her breasts, and went out and fought in the American Revolutionary War. So I am going to get to another story here. This is a woman, another woman in the American. And today's show is all the forgotten heroes of the American Revolutionary War. Now, this woman, she was born in 1728, Barnstable, Massachusetts, in a large into a large Puritan family. 11 children, a stern father, and a world framed by discipline, duty, and devotion to God. Okay. So Puritan family, they had a discipline and a duty and a devotion to God. Education wasn't offered to girls. Like I said, during the 1700s, there was a bit more pressing matters, especially as you entered the war and as tyranny wasn't a distant thing and it was on your front doorstep. Okay. So when her brother studied Latin, Greek, and Enlightenment politics, she snuck into their lessons, okay? So she listened through the door, she borrowed their books, and she learned everything she could. Her father, Colonel James Otis Sr., believed she had the mind for politics, even if society didn't think so. So her father believed that she had the mind for politics, but more importantly, she believed it. She believed she had a mind for politics. So by the time she was 30, Massachusetts was boiling, okay? The British weren't just taxing the tea, they were taxing dignity. The laws were strangling these colonies, taxation without representation, okay? The British soldiers, they were roaming the streets, they were being smug, they were entering into people's homes, and the worst part, if you dared speak out against the crown, you weren't just mocked, but you were watched and in most cases killed if you were to speak out against the crown. So that didn't stop her. She was married to a man named James Warren, okay, a patriot leader and future speaker of the Massachusetts House, by the way. So their parlor became the hub of the revolution. James Warren and this woman, who I'll get to her name here in just a second, Samuel Adams, John Hancock, Paul Revere, they all came through the doors, drank her tea, this woman's tea, and read her drafts. Because while they planned protests in the streets, she was planning attacks of her own in words. So she was using words, politics. Okay, so when her brother, James Otis Jr., a brilliant attorney and early critic of the British tyranny, was savagely beaten by loyalists for speaking out, she didn't go quiet. Okay, so her brother was also a patriot, and he was beaten, savagely beaten by loyalists. So she picked up her pen and she started writing with fire. Now she did use, like I said, at this time, similar to Thomas Paine, people who spoke out in print, they did so under pen names or like, you know, under anonymous names. So she did her work anonymously, but guess what she did? She did political satire. She wrote poems eviscerating loyalist leaders. She wrote plays. She exposed the British abuse and the loyalist cowardice. So the loyalists at the time, not the patriots. And she would mimic British officers full on political theater. This woman was a member of the media, and she ridiculed the loyalists. And here's the twist, though. Nobody knew who she was. The British authorities were really pissed off about this political satire and these poems that eviscerated the loyalists in the colonies. And they really wanted to arrest her. But here's the twist. They had no idea who she was. And to the British, these pamphlets must have come from somebody educated, right? Or a Harvard guy, a Harvard man, a man who was educated, because that's how good these things were, this political satire. they were like, okay, it's got to be a rebellious legislator or a wealthy merchant. And they couldn't find this person who was writing all of this political satire and these pamphlets. So they couldn't believe that it was a woman, let alone a mother of five. So on top of being a mother of five, she managed to write all of this political satire. And they had no idea. She became the ghost of the revolution, a mistress, a mysterious force. And she used this anonymous status of hers to cripple these tyrants with her words. And she did so by raising her children, you know, beside the fireplace. And she wrote these things beside her little fireplace there. And John Adams, yes, the future president, regularly corresponded with this woman. They exchanged letters filled with strategy, philosophy, theology, and they were pretty much like, she was almost like a political consultant, kind of, and she was writing, you know, memes. I mean, she was kind of like the first memer of this time, okay? So I kind of think of it as, you know who Jack Posobiec is. Jack Posobiec, you know, or Charlie Kirk regularly, you know, probably working with politicians and crafting legislation and, you know, working with the people in almost serves as an advisor to the MAGA movement. It's similar in this time period. And I'm trying to think of maybe a female who is a good memer. I can't think of one in the MAGA movement right now. But she was a female memer, and she was working alongside, I mean, John Adams, I mean, and regularly kind of corresponding with her. So she was one of the sharpest political minds in America, and the founding fathers knew that. So she warned of too much central power, of trading one form of tyranny for another. And after the war, when the Constitution was proposed, she didn't just rubber stamp it. She said, wait, okay, where are the guarantees? Where's the Bill of Rights? Okay, so where are the protections for worship, for speech? So she wasn't against the Constitution. Some people read back in history and they say that this woman was against the Constitution. No, she was against power without accountability. And her voice helped the founders to adopt the Ten Amendments, the first Ten Amendments, the Bill of Rights, something that we cherish today. So without her, that might have never happened. She was one of the greatest political minds of this time period. And she picked up her pen one last time. And she wrote the very first comprehensive history of the American Revolution, three volumes published in 1805. And she told the truth, the triumphs, yes, the moral failures and the betrayals and the temptations of power. But she didn't care who approved of this. She printed it and she published it. Not even John Adams, who had once sought her counsel, escaped her pen unscathed. She wrote a scathing letter in reply to some things that John Adams, I mean, they were pen pals. They regularly talked to each other, corresponded to each other, talked about theology and politics. But she even, you know, stood her ground with him when it came to politics. And she was no longer anonymous at this point in 1805. She released these volumes with her name attached to it. And her name is Mercy Otis Warren. So in closing, that is a name worth remembering. Mercy Otis Warren. She was a poet of the Revolution, a woman with her Bible on her nightstand and a quill in her hand, and she dipped it in ink. And this is a name worth standing for, like all of these names. And I think that's going to do it for me today. I think that's pretty much all I had. I appreciate you guys being here and sticking with me. It's a little bit shorter of a show today. I'll go ahead, take some of your chats here. Yes, this is live. Yes, I appreciate you. Super smart. Okay. I appreciate you guys listening. I'm just going to check your chats, see if there's anything. I and many friends talk about your show often. Oh, appreciate it. Valuable content, conversations about local and world, impactful issues. Let's hope this keeps going. I appreciate it. You guys can always subscribe. Email me, conservativecatbarker@gmail.com. I appreciate you tuning in today. And remember, our freedom isn't free, okay? And this is one of the greatest nations on earth. And I think that all of our stories sort of reflect this, that it didn't just take grit, but it took the power of God. A lot of these people, they were Puritans. They were Quakers. They were people who were devoted to Christ and devoted to God and the Bible. And, you know, this show wasn't about fireworks, hot dogs, although I love all of that. This was about candle wax and gunpowder. Just think of that smell. And this is about courage that was consecrated in blood and passed down with trembling hands and heavy hearts. And always, when I look up at the night sky, I think about the forgotten heroes of the American Revolutionary War. And these men and women particularly stood out to me, so I wanted to share their names with you. I appreciate you. Have a great day. Smash that like button and subscribe to the channel. We'll talk again on Monday. We'll be back to our regular schedule, 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. Central Time, Monday through Friday. Be blessed and happy Independence Day.